I'm reading from the November 28th issue of the Miami Herald last year. Palm Beach multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein has been a free man, despite sexually abusing dozens of underage girls. According to police prosecutors, his victims have never had a voice until now. A decade before hashtag MeToo, a multimillionaire sex offender from Florida got the ultimate break on a muggy October morning in 2007. Miami's top federal prosecutor, Alexander Acosta, had a breakfast appointment with a former colleague, Washington, D.C. attorney Jay Lefkowitz. It was an unusual meeting for the then 38-year-old prosecutor, a rising Republican star who had served in several White House posts before being named U.S. Attorney in Miami by President George Bush. His client, Palm Beach multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein, age 54, was accused of assembling a large cult-like network of underage girls with the help of young female recruiters to coerce into having sex acts behind the walls of his opulent waterfront mansion as often as three times a day. The eccentric hedge fund manager, whose friends include former President Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, and Prince Andrew, was also suspected of trafficking minor girls, often from overseas, for sex parties at his other homes in Manhattan, New Mexico, and the Caribbean. Facing a 53-page federal indictment, Epstein could have ended up in prison for the rest of his life, but on that morning of the breakfast meeting, a deal was struck, an extraordinary plea agreement that would conceal the full extent of Epstein's crimes and the number of people involved. Not only would Epstein serve just 13 months in a county jail, but the deal, called the non-prosecution agreement, essentially shut down an ongoing FBI probe into whether there were more victims and other powerful people who took part in Epstein's sex crimes. One last paragraph. The pact required Epstein to plead guilty to two prostitution charges in state court. Epstein and four accomplices named in the agreement received immunity from all federal criminal charges. Even more unusual, the deal included wording that granted immunity to any potential co-conspirators who were also involved in Epstein's crimes. This is the story of how Epstein, bolstered by unlimited funds and represented by a powerhouse legal team, was able to manipulate the criminal justice system, and how his accusers, still traumatized by their past, believe they were betrayed by the very prosecutors who pledged to protect them. And one of those prosecutors, of course, is Alexander Acosta, who until today was the labor secretary in the Trump administration. We reached out to Renato Mariotti, who is a former federal prosecutor and who has, I don't know. Renato, welcome back. Have you ever dealt with cases like this before?
Well, I certainly investigated human trafficking cases and sexual exploitation of minors cases, but never a case quite like this one, because it is an astounding case, a heinous case. For instance, I investigated a man who sexually exploited a number of children, but the sheer number that Mr. Epstein did dwarfs that by quite a substantial degree. So this is, I would say, an extraordinary case by any measure, but I certainly handled cases of this type.
Well, as a former federal prosecutor, what do you make of the deal that they were, that Epstein's people were able to get from Acosta's people?
I would call it extraordinary, and I mean that in the ordinary sense of the term. It's a very unusual deal. Typically, when the feds are zeroing in on somebody who has exploited a minor, you are very reluctant to do any kind of deal that isn't going to result in criminal charges. I will tell you, I had a case where I was investigating federally federal charges against someone who had exploited minors, and I ultimately, we didn't bring federal charges, state charges were brought because of a lack of evidence. So it does happen, but I will say that, you know, here, some of the unusual things about this agreement are that it purports to immunize co-conspirators. And it's really hard to understand why the United States of America would agree to do that. In other words, why would a federal prosecutor say that we're not going to bring charges against all these co-conspirators, you're not negotiating with the co-conspirator. You're negotiating with Epstein. Very unusual. It's also that the agreement seems to be very sloppily drafted because the Justice Department only allows U.S. attorney's offices to bind their own office. In other words, there's a U.S. attorney here in Chicago. I used to work. There's one in Miami, and they're all over the place. You don't want to have it so that every office has to get the permission of every other office when they enter an agreement. But there are steps that the justice manual that U.S. attorneys have to follow put forward so that you limit your agreements just to that particular office. Some of the language here suggests that they were trying to limit it. Some of it does not. It's very sloppy, and it's going to be a point of contention in the current Epstein agreement. So there's a lot of things that are unusual about it. Of course, the most unusual is that they failed to notify the victims as required by law, and of course, that's been a subject of great controversy.
I wonder what would motivate them to then cut such a good deal for Epstein.
Yeah, it raises really important questions. Okay, what Secretary Acosta got up and said yesterday was that it was all due to a lack of evidence or proof issues that they had, and as I said, in and of itself, that's plausible in the abstract, but when you get down to the specifics you actually had a 53-page indictment that was drafted by the federal office that Mr. Acosta used to head up, and that the former state's attorney, the Palm Beach County state attorney, said yesterday, he issued a statement saying if Mr. Acosta was truly concerned with the state's case and felt he had to rescue the matter, he would have moved forward with the 53-page indictment that his own office drafted. Instead, Mr. Acosta brokered a secret plea deal. Mr. Acosta should not be allowed to rewrite history. Very strong words from the state's attorney there that seems to contradict what Mr. Acosta put forward yesterday, a version of events that in which he essentially was blaming the victims by saying that they were going back on their story.
I want to talk to you about that evidence thing, but, the Miami Herald didn't have much trouble finding people that were willing to talk about it. It seems to me like there's evidence everywhere in this case.
It certainly does. So what I would say is, based upon my review of the investigative journalism that was done by the Miami Herald, there's an ample number of victims who are willing to come forward and testify against Epstein, and it looked to me like there was very credible evidence there.
Some of them are 14, by the way. Keep going.
Yeah. And then obviously, as we know, the Southern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office determined there was sufficient evidence to go forward now with charges. Now, it is currently 2019. Mr. Acosta was considering charges back in 2007. There's no way that the evidence is going to be better in 2019 than it is in 2007. Memories get worse over time. It's always the evidence is going to be better closer to the event. I mean, certainly there are exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. And so I don't want to say that I don't know for certain what all the evidence is that Mr. Acosta had in front of him, but it's very questionable. And you can see why people are outraged about it.
Well, there's a number of cases that have come through Chicago lately where now we're all playing armchair prosecutor or juror, but we say, in the case of Jussie Smollett or R. Kelly, don't you guys make those decisions? Let's put it in front of a jury or a judge and let them decide. I understand how prosecutors are loath to bring cases they don't think they can win, but maybe you don't know and you ought to go ahead and give it a try before you say drop charges or cut somebody a sweetheart deal.
Well, I will say that these are the type of cases where prosecutors are more likely to do it. So when I was a prosecutor, we often were very careful about, as you've pointed out, bringing cases that we knew we could win, that we were very confident that we were certain we could win, because federal prosecutors are faced with lots of different possible cases they can bring, and they have to pick and choose amongst them. So you should choose, logic says you should choose your strongest cases and let the state handle the remainder of them. But On these are the type of cases where the office, my former office, was willing to take gambles and take a case that, you know, they thought they could prove, but there was some risk there because the danger to victims, to minor victims, is so great. So there's been a number of those cases in the past that my former office took. I think they did that again today with R. Kelly. I think this is another case where obviously there was a prior not guilty verdict from on the state side for R. Kelly, and they decided it was in the public interest to go forward. And I think that's what the Southern District did. They took a little bit of a risk as well with that prosecution, knowing Epstein's got a lot of resources, and really took the offensive back in 2007 against the Southern District of Florida.
Well, maybe you just answered the question that was on my head then, because I'm like, well, what's the risk? If the risk is that we won't win, and that's embarrassing to a federal prosecutor, I would hate for that to be the reason that they wouldn't prosecute a case. But if putting these women through the trauma of having to testify, and you don't win, and so you've traumatized them again, it sounds like that's what you're saying, Renato. That's the risk, huh?
There's even more to it than that. So let's say there's a not guilty verdict in a high profile case. Let's say Mr. Epstein proceeded to trial, and there really were proof issues. I'm not saying that there were. There was not, but let's say there's really evidentiary issues, and you lose trial, and he's not guilty on all those counts. What it sends the message to is that you can commit serious crimes and get away with it. Potentially to people who are considering wrongdoing, or it tells victims that maybe their rights can't be vindicated, or that coming forward doesn't achieve results. Now, you can debate it. I mean, not bringing the charges, you know, there can be a reasonable debate about it, but you could imagine it sending the wrong message. Similarly, it also is a credibility issue for the office. In other words, if you're a prosecutor, you want defendants to say, okay, if they bring charges, they probably got it. They can prove them. And you don't want them to think that, half the time they could beat it.
Former federal prosecutor Renato Mariotti is on a phone line. So then they say, okay, how about two counts of prostitution? I think one with a minor. You go to jail for 18 months. You really only serve 13. You get out for half a day. You can hire your own private security team to make sure your life is safe and comfortable. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that part of the agreement?
Well, I mean, I think with all of this, what I think listeners are probably getting a sense of is that justice is different for the rich and powerful. And what happened here is Mr. Epstein hired attorneys who were very aggressive. And there's been public reports that they started investigating the prosecutors in the case. I will say when I was the federal prosecutor that I was the subject of defense counsel at times making attacks against me personally. That happens when you are going up against very well compensated, aggressive defense counsel. That's just part of the nature of the business. And
What does that even mean? They're aggressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, they're aggressive. They're working for their client. But what do they tell you? They're going to break your kneecaps? What do you care if they're aggressive?
Sure. Great question. So sometimes that may involve making allegations that the attorneys are engaged in misconduct. Sometimes it means making allegations that the attorneys are lying to the court and trying to personalize the issues and go after the attorneys personally, say that they're, you know, there have been times where prosecutors or attorneys have had disciplinary actions opened against them by defense counsel. I don't know here exactly what the nature was of the sort of investigation that they were doing of the attorneys personally, but I do know more broadly that what I've just talked to you about has occurred.
Yeah.
For me, the situation was defense counsels accusing me of misconduct and so on, and the judge disagreed with them. But in both cases, it was very, expensive, very aggressive defense attorneys who were trying to do whatever they could for their client, and they thought that that would put me on the defensive.
Okay. So then you've got so now Acosta and his people allow this to go forward. It's not going to be a federal case. He'll get the sweetheart deal at state charges. The FBI investigation is shut down.
Right.
And I don't know how that office felt about that. If they thought, okay, that's the best we can do. or maybe because it's a billionaire, a multimillionaire, and these people have connections. There's a network I don't know about, and it was just too awkward for them to punish this guy to the full extent of the law. He then becomes labor secretary. I wonder, in the vetting of him, if this would have... wait, I know this came up, but I wonder how they were able to look around that.
It's a great question. I know there's been some public reporting about the vetting process of various nominees and how various red flags were raised and many were ignored. I don't know what the process was over there, but you would think that this is something that would be a significant red flag. I will say, though, to the credit of the journalist, Julie Brown, who did this investigative reporting for the Miami Herald, is, you know, this was considered a dead case, an old case, a case that people weren't thought was in the past but weren't as interested in, and perhaps the administration thought that there would not be the level of public concern and fallout that there has been.
Well, clearly the president didn't think it was that big of an issue, and I asked Steve Bertrand, I said, you know, isn't it possible that you could have, you know, made a big mistake as a former federal prosecutor or a plumber, whatever, but now you have this new job, and the president said he seemed to be a terrific labor secretary. So isn't it possible that one doesn't necessarily affect the other? Steve said, well, the labor secretary is also in charge of child labor laws and those sorts of things. And if a guy is prostituting children and this guy, trafficking children, thank you, Griffin, and this guy didn't do enough to intervene in that case, the last job he should have would be one as a labor secretary. I suppose you see the symmetry there, huh?
For sure. And there was also people talking about, I guess, the Acosta slash some funding for human trafficking work that the department was doing. I would just say as well that this isn't a question of judgment, and if somebody is and what appears to be potential corruption by Mr. Acosta, or at the very least very bad judgment on his part, you want somebody in a position of authority to exercise proper judgment and to be free of undue or unwarranted influence.
Last comment from you, Renato Mariotti.
I think what this should tell all of us is that when there is potential exploitation of children, we should report it and we should encourage victims to come forward.
It's too bad that somebody has to say that, but yeah, I'm glad you did. Renato Mariotti, former federal prosecutor here in Chicago. As always, thanks for your time and expertise, Renato.
Thank you very much.